भरताय प्रतिबोधितगता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृतिथां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसंस्थामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणीम्. We're on verse 14. Sarvendriyagunabhasam Sarvendriyagunabhasam Sarvendriyavivarjitam Sarvendriyavivarjitam Asaktam sarvabhrichayva Asaktam sarvabhrichayva Nirgunam gunabhoktracha Nirgunam gunabhoktracha Sarva Indriya Guna Abhasam Sarva Indriya Vivarjitam Asaktam Sarvabrit Cha Eva Nirgunam Guna Bhoktra Cha. This section is dealing with what we call adhyaropa apavada, so I'm going to be talking about that a little bit. Adhyaropa means the superimposition, the thing which is superimposed, and the apavada is the negation of whatever it is that's superimposed. And so if you go back to the previous verse that we did last week, it's saying basically that tat nyayam, tat means that Brahman which is to be known, is all hands and feet, pani padam, all hands and feet, the one who is everywhere, all eyes, all heads, all mouths, the one who is all ears, the one who, having pervaded everything, you know, in the loka, in this world, or you could take the loka means in the world, in all of the beings, the one who is all the hands, feet, etc., having pervaded everything, sarvam avritya, that one who remains there, means stationary, immovable, having pervaded everything. So there's two things. So the self is, the Brahman is, the one who is all hands and feet, all the beings, the one who is all of them. So everything, and then everything in the creation, having pervaded everything in the creation, the one who remains there. So having said that, we're taking into account the whole Ishvara. So we're saying Brahman is all of this. All of the living beings, you know, all of the Ishvara is all of the living beings and everything, because it says sarvam. So all of the living beings in the world and everything, having pervaded the whole creation, the one who abides there, the one who remains there. So that Brahman, now there's the problem that you may think that Brahman is all of this, right? Because it just says that Brahman is all of this. Well, then that's a problem. Then we have to go into the satyam mitya, because Brahman is all of this, but Brahman is free of all of this. So all of this is Brahman, but Brahman is free of all of this. And that's what now has to be talked about. So he starts by saying, having said this, that Brahman is all of the indriyas, really. All of the indriyas. Indriyas means we have two types of indriyas. Jnana indriyas. The jnana indriyas means the sense organs. Organs of knowledge. Indriya means organ. So jnana indriya, the organs of knowledge are the five sense organs. The karmendriyas are the organs of action, like your hands, feet, vak, speech, sexuality, evacuation. Those are the organs of action. And so these indriyas, so now what he says, sarva indriyas, all of the indriyas, all of the organs, meaning the jnana indriyas and the karmendriyas, the organs, the sense organs, and the organs of action, all of them, they're gunas, sarva indriya guna, sarva indriya guna, all of their functions, gunas means all of their attributes, like the eyes see, that's what they do, they see, the ears are hearing, that's their function, the hands have the function of grasping, you know, or holding. So all of these gunas, all of the functions of all of the indriyas, abhasam, the appearance, the abhasa is like the adhyaropa. So here, if we go to the subject of the sentence is tatnyayam, that Brahman which is to be known, sarvendriya guna abhasam, appears, or is taken to be, appears to be, all of this, all of the functions of all of the sense organs and all of the organs of action. The abhasa is the one who appears to have all of those attributes. But because we've just said, all of this, all of the jivas, with all of their sense organs and all of their organs of action, all of the living beings, Brahman is all of this. Right? He has all of the hands that are his. All of the eyes are his. All of the mouths are his. All of the ears are his. So now it says, that Brahman, sarvendriya guna abhasam, appears to have, seems to have, all of these attributes, all of these functions. So the one, that Brahman, sarva indriya guna abhasam, who is appearing with all of these, we could say it like that, that Brahman who is appearing with all of these sense organs and their functions, and all the karmendriyas and their functions of all beings, that one is sarva indriya vivarjitam. That same one who is appearing as all of this is vivarjitam, without, free from all of them. The one who is appearing of all, as all of these, has all of these attributes, as though has all of these attributes, in the Bhasha they'll say eva, as though has all of these attributes, that same one is vivarjita, free of sarva indriya, of all of the indriyas. So the one who is appearing as all of this, who is as though all of this, that same one is free of all of this. This is the satya mitya. The adhyaropa is recognizing all of this creation is Ishwara. All of this is Brahman, right? Brahman is all of this. This is Brahman. This is the form of Brahman. And then you have to also understand that this form of Brahman, which is Ishwara, that Brahman, which is appearing in this way, that same Brahman is free of this whole appearance, of this entire creation. So the Brahman who is this entire creation is also free of this entire creation. So you can't be all of this and also be free of all of this unless you understand satyam mitya, unless you understand that relationship. The relationship between satyam mitya, that which is mitya, depends totally upon what is satyam for its being. It has no being of its own. And that's why you can have this very kind of unusual relationship. The unusual relationship is this. This whole creation is me, and I am totally free of this whole creation. It's not equal. You know, equal would be, like when we're doing the Mandukya Upanishad, they say this word tulyam, if you remember in the verse that we just did. The akara is vishwa. The letter a, va-u-m, the letter a is vishwa, is vishwa or vaishvara, stands for virat. And virat is the akara. They're equal. If I say a, that means virat. I'm talking about Virat, I'm talking about the Akara. There's no Satyam Mitya there. There is equality. The A is this, because Nama. The Akara is the name for Vishwa, right? And Vishwa is the one who is named by the Akara, by the letter A. The U, right? The Ukara is Tajasa. Tajasa and the Ukara are one and the same. They equal each other. They're on the same level of reality. But here, this is not tulyam. This is not the same. If it were the same level of reality, we would say, this universe is Brahman and Brahman is this universe. Right? That shows identity. That's when we say the Sorry, I'm stuck on the apavada. Well, I can say it in English and I'll remember the Sanskrit in a minute. It's been blocked in my mind. If I say, this shows identity. When this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. Right? When this, and via vyatireka. Okay, very good. When this is. Yeah, you get a star, you get a gold star. Okay. When this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. That's just equality. This is dependent on that. They're dependent on each other. When this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. They depend on each other. But if you can say something like, when this is, that is. And when this is not, that is not. When this is, that is. When this is not, that still is. There's no relationship there. You know, that's, this is exactly what, this is, this anvayavyatireka is one of the tools that we use to separate my being from the creation. Because that's our, this anvayavyatireka, this is our experience. This is the reality of all of our experience, in fact. It goes like this. When I'm experiencing this, I am. When this experience is gone, I still am. That's the anvayavyatireka. Here, we're doing, this is a little bit different, but I just want to juxtapose these two teaching methodologies. For the apavada, the adhyaropa apavada, the adhyaropa is when I'm looking at Brahman as all of this, through the eyes of the upadhi. The upadhi means the conditioning agent. I'm looking at Brahman from this side, from the side of the creation. And from the side of the creation, I would say, this whole creation, everything that we experience, all beings, all hands, all legs, all of this is Brahman. And that is true. It is all Brahman, it is only Brahman. But the other side, if I come from the standpoint of Brahman, I would say Brahman is free of all of this. Brahman is not, Brahman is only Brahman. Brahman is only Satchitananda. It's the same thing, the apavada, the adhyaropa. Say if I take the clay pot. The adhyaropa is the pot. You know? I'm seeing clay as a pot. The adhyaropa is putting the potness on the clay. Right? And it's true, isn't it? I see the clay as the pot, and from the standpoint of the pot is clay, but the adhyaropa, what we mean by that, that superimposition, is I'm putting potness onto the clay. See that? I'm taking the, it's almost as though the clay has the pot as its quality. You see, like the clay, that's how I look at it. The clay has the pot as its quality. It has potness. That's the adhyaropa. So now what, it's the same thing, like if I say, you know, Brahman is all of this. I'm putting all of this onto Brahman. I'm putting the creation onto Brahman, the nature of the creation onto Brahman, as though Brahman changes by or the quality of the creation is a quality of Brahman. Just look at the, is the pot a quality of clay? We'd say, there's only clay there. It's you can't categorize. We can't categorize the pot. We can't say that the pot isn't there. We can't say that the pot is non-existent. But we can't say it's the clay either, right? Because there is only clay. There's not a second thing. That's why the definition, one of the definitions of mithya, is sad asad pyam, anirvachaniya. It can't be described or it can't be categorized as real, that which is actually there, and it can't be categorized as not there either, you know. And so this is the situation that we call mithya. So the next level of understanding mithya is to say, what we are calling mithya, what deserves the title mithya, the name mithya, to be categorized as mithya, means that it doesn't exist apart from the vastu, apart from what actually is there. It has no being other than what is actually there, what is the satyam. and yet we experience it. That is mitya. So when we do this adhyaropa apavada teaching methodology, what we're saying, first of all, we're looking at Brahman as all of this. And so this is pure satya mitya, and it's a very powerful teaching methodology, because if I say, it's just with a creation, if I say, Brahman is all of this, there's nothing here that is not Brahman, right? Then there's no way of you escaping Brahman. What if I say like this, Brahman is this body. But Brahman is not only this body, and Brahman is this mind, and Brahman are these sense organs, right? Brahman is also your mind, and your body, and your sense organs, and your ahankara, and your hands, and your feet, and your hands, and your feet, and all of the intervening space. Brahman pervades this, all of this equally, like the pot, like the clay, equally, as though pervades. See, as though pervades the pot. When we use the word pervades in this sense, there's really no pervasion. The clay's not pervading the pot, because there's no pot apart from the clay. But from the standpoint of this creation, we use terms like avritya, having pervaded, as though there's something to pervade. See what I mean? It's important to understand, because then otherwise you think of Brahman as kind of pervading, swishing through the creation, pervading the whole thing, as though there's a creation that can somehow be a vehicle or a receptacle of Brahman. It's not that kind of pervasion. It's the clay pot pervasion. It's just what it's saying is that's really all that is there. So having pervaded everything, Brahman remains. Another way maybe of saying it, being everything, Brahman remains. In the sense of pervasion, it is everything, and being everything, Brahman tishtati, it abides there. Tishtati means it stays, it remains. It's not moving. Right? So what is actually here is tishtati. It is not moving at all. It is not changing at all. But it is the self of everything that is here. So from the standpoint of the creations, you would say, like if I were speaking personally to you, your hands, your feet, your head, your mouth, your hands, your feet, your hands, your feet, etc. And to every living being, to the mosquito, to the animals, to all beings, saying, all of you, without exception, are Brahman. Everything about you, all of your qualities, all of the qualities of your hands, all of the qualities of your feet, all of the qualities of your mouth and your head, everything about you is only Brahman. And not only that, everything you experience also, that is Brahman. Everything about you as the knower, as the upadhi, as the jiva upadhi, that is Brahman. And everything in between, because having pervaded sarvam, having pervaded everything, you know, Brahman remains. And so now at this point, with this verse, then you have to say, okay, what they mean is by Brahman, when we say the word Brahman, what we mean is all that is. Everything that exists, everything that is experienced, all of that is Brahman. That's what this verse says. So having said it's all hands pervading everything, it abides. Right? Having all of the hands, etc., and then pervading everything that is, it just simply remains there. And then it says, now at this point, so this Brahman is taken to be it as though has all of the functions, all of the qualities of all of these sense organs, all sense organs. So it's because by using here sense organs and organs of action, it's including consciousness. If we're just talking about the table, or we're talking about the rug, or even if we're talking about space, we're not including, we are including consciousness, but we need to bring in another prakriya, another teaching methodology to make that clear. When we're talking about Brahman being, you know, all beings, all sense organs, and all organs of action, you can't have that without consciousness. So that means, by saying that, it means that, okay, you and your sense organs are Brahman, your sense organs and what you are doing are now are now abhasa. They now are appearing as Brahman, or as though Brahman. All of these things are Brahman, all of their functions, right, Brahman appears to be all of these things. It's now appearing to be all of these things. Why appearing? Because sarva indriya vivarjitam, Brahman is actually free of all of these things, devoid of all of these things. So all of these things that you had taken, this universe that you had taken to be real, first of all you say, you know, Brahman is all of this. Now we move a little differently. Well, Brahman is actually appearing, abhasa. It's really an adhyaropa. It's an abhasa on Brahman, because Brahman actually, having pervaded everything from the previous verse, remains without any motion at all. Brahman has no functions. The sense organs are functioning. The organs of action are functioning. The world is functioning. It's changing. It has so many gunas. It has so many qualities. Brahman has no gunas. It has no qualities. Pervading and being the self of all of this, Brahman isn't doing anything. Brahman is vivarjitam. It's free of all of this. The whole creation, because in the previous verse, it starts with the Panipada, all of this, and then says having pervaded everything. And you think, well, okay, all of this is Brahman. No, all of this appears to be Brahman because Brahman is actually free of all of this, vivarjitam. That's the second part. Then he says, Brahman is actually the Brahman, that which is to be known, the Satchit, the conscious being, which is in fact you, that one that is to be known, is actually asakta. Asakta means completely unattached. Completely unattached. Asanga. Asakta is just a past passive participle of asanga. It's a nominal form. What that means is this. Your eyes are seeing. Your eyes are seeing. And they're seeing, the consciousness which is allowing them to see, is Brahman. But Brahman is not seeing. Your ears are hearing. And because of consciousness, there is that knower known relationship. But from Brahman's standpoint, there's no sound. Your mouth is talking, but Brahman isn't talking, right? Your mind is thinking, Brahman isn't thinking. Your emotions are raging, but Brahman is still and quiet. So it's like saying, you know, all of the activities from the standpoint of the activities, from the standpoint of the body, from the standpoint of the sense organs, from the standpoint of the mind, you know, Brahman is doing all of these things. That's the tricky thing to understand. This is all of this, this body, mind, sense organs, is Brahman. That means that from my eyes, Brahman is seeing. My ears, Brahman is hearing. From the standpoint of my ears, thinking, Brahman is thinking. Emoting, Brahman is emoting. Brahman is talking. Brahman is engaged in activity. But you can only say that from the standpoint of the upadhi, from the standpoint of Brahman. And remember, I'd really understand this, that the upadhi means this conditioning object, this universe, this body, mind, sense organs, is Brahman. Because there's nothing but Brahman. But that's why we can say Brahman is my hands. Brahman is grasping. Brahman is walking. Brahman is seeing. Brahman is thinking. Brahman is having complexes. Brahman has an unconscious. Brahman has a jnanam. Whatever is nothing but Brahman. But if you say that, you know, if you know what you're saying, then what you're saying, what you're meaning to say, is this. Brahman as though sees. As though means, that's the abhasa. As though means from the standpoint of the eyes, which have no being apart from Brahman. Brahman sees. From the standpoint of the ears, Brahman hears. Right? But what about just from the standpoint of me, the self? Is consciousness all of a sudden, like say, that conscious being, my own Atma, myself, it would be very noisy for Bhagavan, for the self. Say this, the consciousness now, consciousness is seeing, right? Consciousness is seeing. Consciousness is hearing. Then when my consciousness is hearing, right, then my consciousness becomes limited because the conscious being that I am is hearing, but are you hearing what I'm hearing? So you have to have your own consciousness. You become a knower, you know? So if everything starts to fall apart in action, if you're seeing, if I'm seeing, you know, and consciousness is one, Brahman is limitless, and I'm seeing, then you should be seeing what I'm seeing. This is kind of the Sankhya has a problem like this. And so what Sankhya will end up gets very confused, and what Sankhya will say is, okay, well, everybody has their own Brahman. Everybody has their own Purusha, because they take the knowership to belong to the Purusha, to Brahman. But if knowership, you know, doership belongs to Brahman, then when I'm doing something, then you should all be doing it. Okay? So it becomes very problematic. If I'm seeing something, you should be seeing something. So that's what's being said. Pervading everything, Brahman does not move. Brahman is asakta. The self is asakta. It's not, asakta means asanga. It's not attached to anything. And so what I need to be able to see and say, seeing, I'm free from seeing. Thinking, I'm free from thinking. Hearing, I'm free from hearing. Emoting, I'm free from emoting. And both have to be recognized by you. One is an activity that's taking place from the standpoint of the upadhi, and the other is just from my own nature. And both are happening simultaneously. What I mean by that, accepting the upadhi here and accepting the universe as being here, and all of us being in the universe, you know, and all of us having the, you know, teacher-student relationship, trying to gain knowledge and all of this kind of stuff. This whole duality is here. Okay? And so, the nature of my being as I am is here, and the upadhi also is here, right? I am here, this manifest creation is here. Since this upadhi is here, the manifest creation is here. And so, that being the case, if this upadhi, if Ishwara, this manifestation of Ishwara, if in this manifestation of Ishwara, there are eyes, there are jivas, and there are eyes, and there are ears, and there is your voices, and talking, and grasping, if all of these things are taking place, right? Then from the standpoint of these things that are taking place in this mithya creation, Brahman is seen from the standpoint of the from the standpoint of the creation, from the standpoint of the eyes. But with reason we say as though seen is because Brahman, or my being, is not doing anything. I'm not seeing. My eyes are seeing. I'm not thinking. My mind is thinking, you know. But my mind has no being apart from me. Right? My mind is really only me. My eyes are really only me. And so then I have to say, I am as though thinking. That's the abhasa. I am as though thinking. But since I am here and I'm not thinking, and I'm not seeing, and I'm not hearing, I have no attachment at all to any of these organs of action or any of these sense organs or to anything that I perceive. And so you can shift from the standpoint your mind can shift back and forth to its participation, you know, acknowledgement of seeing, hearing, and being a jiva in the world, being a person in the world, to recognizing, because of the viveka, recognizing all the while that itself is not doing anything. Now, the thing is that the being that you are, the me, because you are self-evident. It's not that the mind is looking at you and saying, oh, look, the Brahman, look at Brahman isn't doing anything. As though the mind is the one who's illumining Brahman. It's not that the mind is illumining Brahman. The conscious being that you are, the me, is self-evident. It doesn't require the mind. You are self-evident, and you are never doing anything. And so the mind can differentiate its own illumined activity, right, from the me that is never doing anything at all. And so this type of viveka is just kind of a part of your life. Once the viveka is there, then the asakta, the changeless, unaffected nature of yourself is who you are, abiding in all of this activity. So I, doing nothing, not doing anything, am talking to you. You, not doing anything, are listening to me. Or feeling your foot, or whatever it is that you're doing. Both things are taking place. So the asakta me, what the beauty of this recognition is that no matter what you're going through or what's going on in the world or what unconscious processes you're going through, what type of emotional reaction happens to be there, or the things that we try to avoid and get rid of, all of that is going on, but I am asakta. That means that it is going on, but nothing is happening to me. And so to recognize that in the recognition of that freedom, the mind has a refuge. The truth of the mind is the refuge of the mind. Truth of the body is the refuge of the body. The truth of the Prarabdha, the truth of Ishwara, is the refuge of all beings. The truth of Ishwara is the refuge of all beings. The truth of my body is the refuge of me, right? And so that the truth, in fact, is the refuge, and I am that truth. And that the so it says the one who is to be known, that one is asakta, and at the same time, sarvabrit. The one who is asakta, ever free, is also the one who is the support of everything, the brit, the one who bears everything. Means we use the word adhishtana. The sarvabrit is the adhishtana of everything. Adhishtana is the word that we use for the relationship between mitya and satyam. This creation totally depends and is supported by Brahman. Brahman is the adhishtana. Brahman is what is actually there that the mitya as though rests on, as though the snake is resting on the rope. Right? The rope is the sarvabrit. Brit means the one who bears, who holds. It's the rope that's holding the snake, as though there's a real snake there. Right? The rope's not holding the snake, but without the rope there, there can be no snake. And so without Brahman, which is the satyam, the reality, there can be no creation. So Brahman is the one who is the support for the whole universe, and then, of course, for the whole universe, the support for this body, mind, sense organs. And so Brahman here, if you say sarvabrit, the one who holds everything, that's the adhishtana. But then being the adhishtana, the support, being asakta, means, from the standpoint of Brahman, there is no attachment to anything, you know. And then, being the support of everything, you know, but then Brahman is the support of everything, then you think, well, what is the relationship again to all of this? If so, it's the support of everything, but Brahman is nirguna. Supports everything, but nirguna. Nirguna means it supports all of this, it is the self of all of this, the being of all of this. But it itself has no attributes. This creation is nothing but attributes, gunas, qualities, infinite qualities. You know, everything that we see is a quality, in fact. If we try to find, this is just a little aside, if we experience this world, and we say, well, this this is black, this chair is black, blackness is a, the color, is the is a quality, is the color of the of the of the fabric, you know, on the fabric. But then we can go into the fabric itself, you know, and the nature of the fabric. Everything becomes a quality of something. And then as we start searching for these, the something is what we can't find. We're always labeling qualities. We're describing, describing, describing. But then when we try to find out what we're describing, that becomes a problem. That's why we say everything is kind of goes beginninglessly to not being able to find any actual substance here. So all of these things that we say are attributes, we have to figure out, well, what are the attributes of? They just become limitless, limitless attributes of a substance that can't be found. And so here, when we, that's that is the nature of Maya. Just to give a simpler example of this, any, that's why when we just say now that really there's nothing here but names, it's the same idea. Names within names within names within names. So we usually say name and form. The name the name is the name of a form. But there are no forms really. They're just conglomerates that make up the appearance of a form. Any given form that you experience, we call it a form, we give it a name. But upon analysis, there's really no form there. There's just a conglomerate of things that give the illusion of a form. So we can just get rid of the idea of form and just say there's names within names within names within names. And actually, they're just all names for Brahman. Because the only the end, the only being, the only substance that is there really in the end is Brahman. And if you try to find any substance here, all you find is conglomerates that are broken up into smaller forms and smaller forms and smaller forms and smaller forms. You can never get to the end of it, because if you were to get to the end of it, you would have to get to what is formless. As long as it has form, it can be made into smaller forms. So in the end, you just give up the whole idea of forms and just say we have names. Names within names within names within names. And what are they names of? Only Brahman, because Brahman is the only thing that is actually here. See what I mean? So all of this, all of these colors, all of these nama rupas, they're just different. They're just different names for Brahman, because as you go to find what is actually there in the end, what is actually there is only Brahman. And so here, in that Brahman, what? So when we get to the end, okay, all these are names and forms of only Brahman. Well, what is Brahman? What qualities does Brahman have? Yeah. And we'll say, oh, Brahman has no qualities. Brahman is nirgunam. Because once you get to Brahman, and you take off all of the names and forms, because if you keep the names and forms, or any type of form, it's still divisible. You want to get to the substance. But when you finally get to the substance, as though there is a finally, you can never get through Maya to get to that finally, that substance itself has no form, has no names and forms. And so then you have to say, well, Brahman at the bottom of it is nirgunam. It's free of any name and form. And name and form means duality. Name and form means an infinite regress to try to find the substance of the form. You can't do it. And so if you get to the substance that is actually there, you have to give up all name and form. So then Brahman has got to be, what actually is, has got to be nirgunam. Nirgunam means it has no qualities. Consciousness is not a quality. Existence is not a quality. It's not like there's something that has existence, or that consciousness has existence, as though existence is a quality of consciousness. You can't say that. We say that consciousness itself is. There's no dvaita, there's no duality there for consciousness to be a quality of something, or something to be a quality of consciousness. So we say, well, maybe consciousness is a quality of existence. We say, no, neither consciousness or existence can join into the dual world. They're not objectifiable. Neither one is, nor are they separable. And so, in fact, consciousness is. So So consciousness and existence are one and the same thing. They're not a quality of each other. They are the substantive, and the substantive has no qualities. So consciousness is simply consciousness. It's asakta. It's not attached to anything. It has no gunas. It simply is. So what is that in terms of our own self-experience? I simply am. And that amness of my being is self-evident. And my being, the me that I am, I'm not doing anything. From the standpoint of the upadis, I see, I hear, I talk. I engage in relationship and everything that can take place in the world. But while all of that is going on, I simply am. All this activity is going on. In the midst of all of the activity, the truth of all of that activity is just me, nirguna, asakta, not doing anything at all, just simply being. I simply am being. And that is your experience right now. You're seeing, you're hearing, you're talking, and at the same time, that's all as though. I'm as though seeing, I'm as though hearing, because when we say as though, because the one who is doing of all of these things is not doing anything. That's the one who's doing all of it is not doing anything. That's why we say abhasa. And that's why sometimes we just say, I'm as though seeing, I'm as though thinking, because there is nobody else that's doing these things. There's no other self that's doing these things. And at the same time, so it's me that's doing all of these things. It has to be from the standpoint of the upadhi, because actually I'm not doing anything at all. And so then saying, I'm nirguna, then he goes, and I'm guna bhoktra. I'm the one who enjoys, I'm the enjoyer. The one who's enjoying, who's experiencing all of these gunas, all of these functions. I'm the one who's seeing, I'm the one who's hearing. There's nobody else seeing, there's nobody else hearing, there's nobody else appreciating the mind, appreciating what you're thinking. There's nobody else doing that, you know. So you're doing all of that, but you have to bring in that eva. I am doing that from the standpoint of the upadhi. So the one who is the thinker, right? There's nobody else thinking, but thinking from the standpoint with the mind, I am not thinking. While thinking, I'm not thinking. While hearing, I'm not hearing. While seeing, I'm not seeing. But then is there another enjoyer? Like, is there a little Atma or something who's actually enjoying all of these things and having all of these experiences, somebody besides me? No, because there's nobody besides me. So from the standpoint with the upadhi, I see. With the upadhi, I hear. But I'm a sakta. So at the same time that the mitya, all the things that are going on with mitya are going on, nothing at all is happening to me. And so, all of these verses are like this now. So this is really exactly what it is. The thing is when you're listening to all of this, I don't know how it is for you to listen to it, but in the what has to be happening for you, either now in the class or contemplating on it, is while you're sitting here to recognize the truth of it. While you're sitting here, you're listening. For me, my legs are crossed. I feel my legs crossed. I hear myself talking. Everything that we're doing is taking place, you know, and you're hearing it, I'm hearing it, I'm thinking about it. All of these activities are there, true. And at the same time that all of this is taking place, and that is your direct immediate perception, and it is you doing it, nobody else. And at the same time that that is happening, you are also not doing anything. So you're not doing anything, you're doing all of these things. Because what's allowing for all of these things to be done is mitya. The mitya mind is thinking. The mitya ears are hearing. Mitya, you know, everything the mitya hands are grasping. The mitya mouth is talking. So once you say mitya, you know, you can appreciate all of the activity as you, and also yourself as free of all of this activity. Not just as a hypothetical, but as a recognition of the fact. It's almost like you have to be able to say, right now, knowing you and talking to you and experiencing everything that's going on in the room, I'm not doing anything. Knowing I'm not a knower. That's what you have to be able to recognize that. Knowing I'm not a knower. Talking, I'm not talking. You have to see that I am talking from the standpoint of the upadhi, and at the same time, this me that is abiding here and is the very me that is present to all experience is not doing anything. One who is totally present to all of this is totally asakta, totally unattached to all of this, not engaged in all of this, and from its own standpoint, nothing at all is happening. But everything is happening because of the upadhis. So, good. That's this verse. Let's stop there. Purnamidah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
This idea that I am thinking at the same time I'm just illumining the thinking, so I'm not thinking. It seems like it's hard to hold those two contradictory.
Because we're not used to that viveka, but actually you do get used to that once you recognize it, because you are just silently present to amidst all the activity that's going on.
Yeah.
And it sounds contradictory, but it's not contradictory because of the satya mitya.
But the identity seems to stick, it can stick in both places, or one's a mitya identity and one's a real identity. I mean, identity of both seems to be present.
Both experiences are present, but I think what the ahankara becomes mitya. The aham, mm-hmm. Except we have two words, one word ahankara, mm-hmm. and one word aham. Mm-hmm. The ahankara means the identification of me with the upadhi. That's what makes it a hankara. That's why we translate it I notion. Also we say hridya grantihi, the knot of the heart. You know, that's notional. And so it's going to be for somebody who has knowledge that ahankara is still operating because this body, but there's nobody who takes that to be me. Because you are the one, you are the stable one. You're always so the aham lands always with you. You know? But then I can identify with the upadhi also.
Mm-hmm.
Like I could say, I'm tired, or I'm going to go to the store, or I have to read this book. That's also real. I know exactly what I mean. I don't try not to say that. I don't have to say, well, you're not really reading the book when you're reading the book. You know what the body, mind, sense organs, and they're also you. Literally you. It's right. Just you're free of them, and both sides have to be seen.
Yeah. Well, say you're hurting, okay, and that doesn't seem so notional as much as. It seems in I illumining, or I'm conscious of that hurt, seems to be the notional side, and the pain seems to be the.
That's why you have, because, you know, hurt is painful. But that's what it is. So what you have to learn is how to be with that hurt in a way to dispel it. You know, once you start learning to have a relationship with the hurt, or with all of the different types of emotions the mind and the unconscious can throw out. Once you start having a relationship, it starts to lose that ability to totally overwhelm. You know? So when we get totally overwhelmed, the buddhi is overwhelmed. You know, you just kind of get sucked into it. It's kind of like, you know, when you're having a daydream. To have the daydream, you almost have to get sucked into it. Well, where you're often running within the daydream, you've entered into it. Emotions are, and that's kind of powerful. And you find yourself in the daydream, and then you pull yourself out of it. But you know, emotions are like that too, or your raga dvesha are like that too. All of a sudden, the jiva appears. The jiva appearing is taking place as you get pulled into the situation, and your likes and dislikes, the intensity of them pull you in. You know, your hurts, your emotional hurts pull you in. And so you have to get that kaushalam, that kind of skill to be able to disband that, you know. That kind of complex that's overwhelmed you. You have to learn how to do that until you're not tortured in that way anymore. Mm-hmm. You know?
And that skill develops by...
Well, we're practicing that in class. Like, if you do in your meditation,
mm-hmm.
You know, like we have all of these preliminary things you do. One is talking to the little child inside. Another is talking to the conscious mind so that it has that kind of buddhi, which is really Brahman with a voice. It's really your knowledge with a voice.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's caretaking these parts that are hurt. And you start to become, as your mind starts to release some of its pain, you start becoming more even sophisticated in your ability to release the mind. For instance, what I mean by more sophisticated, I don't usually talk that way, so let me give an example. If you have a great dvesha or dislike for someone, they don't even have to be in the room, they can be on the other side of the world, you know, but that dvesha, that tremendous dislike is there, so that it's hard for you to even want to think about that person, because it's a dvesha, you know. Raga is just the opposite. This is a dvesha. But if you know, if you understand the mityatva of the mind and of the world, for that matter, but just take for the mind, if you can allow that image or that situation internally to be there, and to just let the image, whatever it is, to let that image with its affect, to kind of like Rumi says, to welcome it into the house, to your house, and not push it out at all, and just relax. Just relax. What happens? What will happen is that if you truly just relax and don't resist, the image with all of its fangs, you know,
It stings.
Yeah, it can't hold its form. The images are only consciousness. That's their truth. There's really nothing there. So the mitya seems so real.
Yeah.
But it's only mitya. And so if you can withstand the feeling, you know, the animosity, and not even wanting to allow that image into your sight, whatever, however you want to talk about it, if you can allow it to be there, and then you don't have to like it or dislike it, you just let it be there and you relax. Well, what is happening is the mind is relaxing, and really, all that is there is consciousness. And the image or the feeling has no being for it to stay. What's holding it together is your commitment to it. You know? It's kind of like...
Even the wanting to push it away.
All of it, yeah. There's a commitment to it. There's an attachment to it. And you're not willing to let it go. It's kind of like what the jiva is. If you can think about it in terms of a daydream, or even if you're doing a meditation and you watch yourself enter into, instead of just letting the thoughts come and go, you're relaxing, you'll find that you enter in. You enter in to it. And now you're part of the samsara. It's the jiva has been born there. You've entered in. All you have to do is relax. Once you relax, that's that asanga. You just let go. In Buddhism, we call it, you know, non-clinging. You just like you open your hands. You just let it be. Every time you find yourself inside, you just open your hands and see if you can withstand it. If you can withstand it, it's really interesting to watch the whole thing disappear. You know, we have a lot of, and this takes some time and some. By sophistication, I mean experience. Being with this knowledge long enough so that you don't have so much at stake, so much. It's almost like a self-righteous anger. You know, I deserve, you know, this deserves punishment, or, you know, this person deserves to be punished or hated, or they did the wrong thing. And so there's an investment, you know, and you get sick of all that investment. Who cares? You know, you're talking about your own shanti. Let Ishwara take care of the dharma. That you hand over the dharma or the justice and all of this stuff, let Bhagawan take care of that, and let me have shanti. And there really comes a time where you love your shanti, and you don't want to be engaged in the world or toward anybody in that way, because
you lose your shanti,
yeah. So it's not worth it, you know. But it takes a while to get to that place of it really not being something that you want to invest your time in. Because of, you know, self-righteous anger and justice, and this person did a wrong to me. This person did bad to me. They ruined my life. They, if it weren't for that person, things would be a lot better. This person is, whatever it is, you know. But the little wrongs we don't care very much about, but we all have some big wrongs, very big ways in which we were wronged. And those things have to let go of them. Let Ishwar take care of it.
Practice with the little wrongs.
Practice with the little wrongs. That's right.
Some sort of objectivity.
Yeah, you work with the little ones, and then the big ones keep becoming littler. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just hard to, because I know the answer, but sometimes the affairs of the world it's hard to apply it without feeling like you're just turning your back on any action that might.
It's not about turning your back.
I know that.
It's about not being emotionally twisted
by it.
Rather, being objective, you know.
I can see it in my own life as I come more into the knowledge. It's easier for me to act in the world in a way mm-hmm. that doesn't end up being a mess. I can see that, and yet there's still some. As I'm listening to you speak, there's still some. What about this? What about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's hard things, and I think I've told you all that story, you know, when, I don't know, when it was in the early 80s, I guess, when this one person at the ashram, at the first course, was making my life so difficult. If I saw her, I would just go the other way. I just could not deal with it. It was awful. And it's awful for me. I don't know what she probably wasn't anything for her. For me, it was terrible. And it's just a real dvesha, very, very painful. And I used to tell Swamiji about it. How am I going to, like, what can I do? And he would always say, you just go up to her and you say hi and then go. And, you know, that was very hard for me to make myself do. Very hard. It wasn't like I could just say, oh, sure. I would say something like, I can't do that. I couldn't get myself to do it. But when I finally could do it, then that just burst the bubble. And it wasn't a big thing. I just was walked by and said hi. That's all. And then I realized that was such a shock that I could be in so much pain. And I could just go by and say one little thing and it would burst that tension or whatever it was, that, and so the first time I did it, it was hard to make myself do it, but the results were so good that it was easier to do it the next time, and then easier, and then it became something where I just realized that's that kaushalam where you kind of get the knack of that. So if you get grabbed in that way by something, you know how, just on a physical level, how to just move forward and move toward it, and it will dissipate it. And then you learn how to do that internally also, so that you gain kind of a skill. You understand how to break through these type of scary nightmares. It's like you're possessed by something that isn't real.
What about this urge to push something away? That gives it a reality also. That's the wrong approach.
Well, that's a hard one too. Like, that's what I was saying earlier. Like, say there's someone, for instance, who you just can't stand the sight of them. And so now you try to bring them into your mind and you don't want to do it.
No, you right? want to keep them out.
Yeah, you want to push them out. But if you can be there, and remember, what's in your mind is an image. That's all. That person's not in your mind. But the image of that person is causing this emotional reaction in your mind. And so it's like a scary film. You know, if I'm watching a TV show and it gets to the scary with the scary music, I turn it off right away. I don't like that. So say in you have this problem person out there in the world, you know, it's a physical world, this problem person is out there, but you can't even hold the image, or even you won't let yourself have that image or deal with it in your mind because you have that animosity of one sort or another. Okay, so say that's the case. You have to remember that this is only an image. This is a mental image. That is all it is. And here it's loaded with all of this affect. And so when that's the case, you can just do, it's kind of like well, there's different type of we call this meditation different types, but you can just let that be there just objectively and just continue to let your mind and body relax. And what happens is that this image with all of its affect relaxes away. It relaxes away. It is not real. That's what I'm saying. The thing isn't real. These things aren't real. They're all of it. Even this external person out there, they're not entering into you. They're over there. Swamiji will say, you know, he used to always say to me when I was suffering from all this stuff, don't let anybody enter into you. Don't let them in. Don't let them enter in. And I never really, it took me a long time to even know what he meant. But what he meant is that they are out there. Everybody's out here. But they have come in that image. And the image is in there creating all this affect. That's all that's happening. There's nothing, these people have not entered into you. But they've asked, though, entered into you. So now you're stuck.
And the shanta's gone.
Yes, absolutely. So now you're stuck with this mithya image, this mental image that is attracting all of this tension and affect. So it's a miserable image that's been internalized. And it all seems so real, and it is not. And so it's like a nightmare. And you have to just say, a nightmare. There's a nightmare inside. And so you just allow yourself to relax.
You know, that's interesting, and that there's another situation where certain thoughts or situations, you don't even want to consider it.
Yeah.
And then what happens is, over time, because you push it away, you've done curls with it, and it's habit not to consider it. It doesn't even, you don't even know you're having it because you've already, put up the block against it. It's so habitual.
Yeah.
That, and then it sort of, in a way, does become part of you because you've enforced it.
Yeah, and the thing is, as you keep letting down your guard, as your buddhi becomes stronger and your knowledge becomes stronger, you become more conscious of these things.
Mm-hmm. I notice that a lot.
But you notice it.
Yeah, right. Too.
So once you notice it, then that becomes, there's little sadhana. As soon as you notice it. You know, and it's because we don't want this kind of unnecessary suffering. You know, it's an unnecessary suffering, really. Because the ananda that is you is a sangha. It's not being hurt by any of these things. Nothing's happening to you. And the source of your wholeness is there. So it's just these constrictions in the mind, you know, that can be very, very powerful and scary. And so that's why, like when Peter said, you know, start with the small ones. Because you build up trust and strength, you know. And then you're willing to take on the ones that are a little bit harder.
These are the source of procrastination.
I think that you can procrastinate.
It's avoiding some experience that one would find intolerable in some way.
Yeah, or unpleasant. Even
unpleasant.
Even unpleasant, yeah.
Yeah, intolerable is maybe too strong a word.
But in, there are intolerable ones too, but you do it even with unpleasant ones.
Yes, and it can be people or tasks or whatever. Sometimes for me, the image, and you described it as an image and there's always an affect. For me, it seems like there's always a physical component. Like even the faintest thought or...
Well, affects lodge in the body.
Yes.
So you do feel it in the body. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it literally takes the form, as far as I can tell, of some kind of tightening. I mean, there's a literal physical tightening.
But that is...
The letting go.
Yes. But that is why when you're relaxing, you're relaxing the body and the mind. The whole organism, you're relaxing.
So that takes away the influence then?
It relaxes the, I mean, the pain has to do with tension, and relaxation has to do with the release of the pain.
And sometimes allowing a certain kind of pain in, but not the pain of the resistance. Or...
Yeah, allowing the pain in, not the resistance, resisting it. Allowing the pain is relaxing, it's a relaxation, it's an accepting.
And that's what you mean by the opening, and you didn't use the word vulnerable, but a word like that, and you said something about not being protected in some way.
Not pushing it away. It takes some strength and courage, and you have to look at it as a sadhana. It's like a workout, you know. Not everybody likes to go to the gym and work out. I don't. You know, but it's good for you. And so kind of learning how to be with these things, it's a skill. You know, we're not trained in that way. We don't know about these simple skills. With Vedanta, it makes this much easier with the understanding of Vedanta, but even without Vedanta, you can do this. These are techniques for releasing, you know, the mind from these.
But you should have confidence and patience about.
That's what I say. If you start small and you gain the pulla from that, like I did with working with this, going up and saying my little hello, and then actually starting to just take that on, because it becomes easier and easier, and then it just became natural. So, because the result is so beneficial to you, that's worth it.
Well, it's like you've been saying over the years about if you can not express your anger, if you can hold it for maybe 10 minutes, which is sometimes impossible. But if I have done it though, you know, because I hold it for 10 minutes. Then you can have a rational conversation about it. Then you can express your feelings in the communication rather than, you know, making you wrong attack.
Yeah. And it'll also, if you're holding it, it can transform.
Yes. Yes, because you're objectifying it.
Yeah.
You're creating distance from it.
And it's just an emotion. It's, you know.
And it's our... It's not. It's almost like a snake upon a snake, in a sense. There may be a snake out there, but it's the inner snake that's really the problem. That's the fear.
We've internalized the snake. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you say this is a form of karma yoga? Would it fall out?
Maybe in a sense, when we're talking about karma yoga, it's really seeing everything as Ishvara. But this Kaushalam aspect, which we call really, sometimes it's translated as skill in action, that has to do with, you know, applying your knowledge in a sense, knowing how to handle situations. And so these are skills, knowing how to handle your mind, knowing how to handle these raga dveshas, knowing how to handle the emotions or the ways that I get, you know, thrown off by the world. You know, gaining that. And that some of those things take some practice, because you you don't want to deal with it. So you built up over the years defenses. Like I think what you were saying, Penny, it's like these things are difficult to deal with, and your psyche has figured a way to slip through it, you know, without having to deal with it. And so, but these complexes, my Larry Jaffe, who I used to do Jungian analysis with, say, you know, the human being, it's like your psyche protects you from its complexes. The complexes are protecting you from pain, basically. And so what happens is your world has become boxed off by your complex because it's trying to protect you from experiences. So it keeps you away, mm-hmm. you know, from going towards certain things. You don't even think about it. And so what he was saying is, so finally you become conscious of this box, and you're able to break through this complex to find yourself now in another complex, a little bit bigger, you know. And then that box is holding you in, and then you become conscious of that, and you can break through it once you become conscious of it.
You know, when you were
part of what I thought it was like karma yoga is that it seems to lead to the same, in the way that karma yoga, when fully done, leads one to the same
shanti
that jnani would have.
Yeah.
This too leads in that direction.
It does.
In a similar way.
It does. But with the karma yoga, we're looking more at recognizing all of this as Ishwara. And even as though we're doing all of these skills, we're talking right now more psychologically. Mm-hmm. But there does come a time where, in the end, even as from a karma yoga, this is just, it's all Ishwara. It's all karma. It's all the prarabdha karma. This is my situation right now. And there's nobody resisting it. You know, you mature like that where I don't require situations to be in a certain way for me to be comfortable. That's how we mature more and more into that, because you're giving up and giving up and giving up, you know, these raga dveshas on deeper and deeper levels because you don't want them.
To change the topic a little bit, I mean, when they're talking about Brahman, they really mean Brahman. I mean, the world is not really, it has a different order of reality. It's not our little 100 years of life. It's not that significant in comparison to Brahman.
Well, for Brahman, there's no time. It's not like Brahman is old or young. Mm-hmm. For your being, it's the being that you are right now is the being that you are. If you go back in Maya, if you go back a billion years, it's still you. Mm-hmm. You are not a billion years old. You're just the self that you are is the self that you are. It's absolutely free from time. The creation is infinite in size, and it's beginningless, cyclically beginningless. So
what's really important in that picture, I mean, for us, in terms of...
Always look at ourselves in light of the whole creation, and then you're not even a speck of time or a speck of size. If you want, you can look at that, if that's helpful for you. But I think from the dimension that you were experiencing in the creation, you have to be able to experience it as Ishwara. And you experience it as Ishwara when your raga dveshas have not pulled you into it. You know, raga dvesha means I need it to be this way. You don't really need it to be this way. You need it to be just as it is.
I do too need it this way.
Yeah, but that's always a projection.
Yeah.
I need it to be this way is always a projection. You know, like, it's, you're dealing with what is, right? But the I want it to be this way is now I have to make a change. This is how it is right now, but a minute from now, this is how it is right now. This is always how it is right now. But our mind is always lost in, you know, projection into the future. And then looking back into the past also.
Yeah. I mean, they twine around each other.
Yeah, they do.
So you get tired of going on that ride.
Yeah, you get tired of going on that ride. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a fantasy. It's
fun. It's okay to go on the ride, but what if you're made miserable by it? That's the whole thing is the misery quotient. So if I can fly around in the future and appreciate that as Ishwara, that's one thing. But if I fly around in the future thinking, yeah, this is what I want to happen, but that could happen and that could happen and spoil the whole thing, and then it's going to be catastrophic and I'll just end up in, you know, in some terrible situation. The bag lady. I'll end up as a bag lady without even a bag. What were you saying, Peter?
Oh, yeah. For some reason, I got a little bit triggered by and I've had this before, if there's only Brahman here, right? And
you might as well say there's only me here.
Well, that's a different story.
But Brahman is me.
Otherwise, it's a total annihilation.
Brahman is me.
Yeah, that's a whole. Oh, that's the verse. That's emptiness versus fullness. Then
what?
Emptiness versus fullness. Then that's the big difference.
Emptiness is a. Shunyata.
Emptiness is scary to me, you know what I mean?
But part of the problem, emptiness is scary because you equate it to non-existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can look at emptiness as a sangha.
No, it's not.
Actually, it is not non-existence. I don't want to get into that because it's Buddhist.
Like you were saying,
You have to talk to about that within a Buddhist language. So.
No, I like the meat part. Now I feel better.
Well, maybe we'll be offline now, huh?
No. I miss them. I came over here a couple of times. I almost.
Where are they?
Just Timmy.
Our cyber friends. Where are our cyber
friends? But don't you feel? I mean, when everybody's online, I feel everybody online.
Yeah.
That's different when you're
online.
So it's kind of strange. I hope this isn't permanent. Permanent means that I have to do something. I have to really get involved in this thing.
There goes another 3 days.
Yeah, exactly.
Is this expensive, the system you use here?
It's pretty. It's $80 a month.
$80 a month?
Yeah.
That's expensive.
That seems a lot.
I know.
It should work.
There are probably alternatives.
Yeah, there may be alternatives.
I'm sure there's alternatives, but...